Okay, so today I just want you to tell me about your life. My project, as you know, is examining Mi'kmaq history and Irish history, and getting people to tell me about their life stories to try to think about how has colonialism impacted their life, what can we learn from each other's stories. But I'm not going to be interrupting you with a lot of questions while you talk. I just want to know.
Well, anyway, but I think it will help because it will help me guide me to exactly where do you want to go, because, you know, so I wouldn't even consider that as an interjection.
Okay, fair enough.
You know,
so when and where were you born?
Let's start. Okay, my name is Albert Marshall. I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki. But I happen to reside in a community called Eskik-Okanawagi, in English, I guess it's Eskizoni. And
can you tell us what that means?
I was raised and bred here in this part of the community. Because this part of the community before 1939 was just that actually was the size of Eskizoni, which was a very small part of it. And I didn't manage to see not only the effects of what became known as centralization. During the early, I mean, that kicked in 1939, for example. So even in the early 40s, I felt that, you know, we were still somehow self-sustaining, because the wave of people never really got to this community. So we still have some land in which we can farm, and we can also supplement our livelihood from hunting and fishing or whatever, gathering. And then once the main thrust of centralization became a reality, we were no longer able to supplement our livelihood through farming. We somehow still managed to supplement it through hunting and gathering. But eventually, when the population growth was at its max, what is highest, we became totally dependent on some other form of subsistence, which meant the government built a big grocery store here, and then that really affected the core of who you are as a Mi'kmaq, because you were prepared or prepped up to be a provider if and when you become age enough or old enough to come be that part of the that part of your life in which you will yourself have a family. And because when there is no other ways in which people can sustain themselves other than through some form of a social assistance, welfare, etc. And in 1960, for example, when I got married, I was hit with a very difficult decision. Here I am, married, with only a grade 6 education. And I now have to somehow find a way not only how was I going to support my family and whatever kids I may have. So the only thing that we could do, I could do at that time, of course, was that, and I think I have to mention this as well, that I live here in Cape Breton Island. It's approximately 20-some-odd miles west from Sydney. And the small towns or cities here in Nova Scotia that I became to realize were very much prejudiced against us, in which no matter what qualifications one may have, you will never get employment in a non-native communities. So the alternative then that was available for us at that time was, besides the doing like what has been done for a long time, following that migrant worker thing, but that's only a very short, from June until late October or mid-October, and then nothing happens after that. So Massachusetts then became very, very attractive for me, because what little I knew about it, that as a Mi'kmaq person going into a city in which it was made up with so many nationalities, that I had hoped that I wouldn't even stick out in any shape or form. Which I learned later that, you know, you had Mexicans, you got Puerto Ricans, you got blacks, you got Irish, you got Dutch, and so anyway, I ended up there, and you know, odd jobs here and there, and then finally I said, you know, I think I better try to get a better job. So I went to this place, a machine shop, and I applied for a job. And experience? No. 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 Everything is no. But the guy says, he says, I'll tell you what, I'll hire you for 2 weeks and see what you can do. At that point, I was still able to read. Here was a machine shop. And whatever I was going to be doing there, I hoped that I can be able to operate one of those machines one day. So while I was there for this and that, little jobs here and there, I started going to the libraries and try to read up as much as I can about this work that I want to get into. And by gosh, I was lucky, and then I met other people. So while I was doing this and that, you know what I mean, I managed to get involved as much as I could about metalworking. And next thing I know, the 2 weeks has gone by. And the boss tells me, he says, well, you know, I'm quite impressed with your enthusiasm and everything else. I'm going to give you another 6 months. In which he did. And I believe that's all I needed, that 6 months. In which, you know, that became really a good place. Because in a city, I had at that point three kids. And we were doing quite well, but as time went on, or as years slipped by, you know, when I started looking at my own kids, here they were going to school in uniforms. But what I did notice was that they just couldn't get enough of the outdoors. So I begin to think about it, you know. This must have some kind of a very profound effect on them. They know who they are as Mi'kmaq people, but there's no other Mi'kmaq people around other than us speaking it. And I began to think about it, think about them and say, this must have some kind of a very profound effect on them spiritually, because this is something I believe that's very much inherent in our thinking. So finally, we decided, well, let's go for it. Never mind what the outcome would be. Let's pack up and come back to the reserve, in which we're going back there for them. So that before it's too late, they can become regrounded again in their culture, language, and into the natural world. And I think this is something that has been, to me, very rewarding in a way. I mean, yes, we did suffer a lot of hardships because on a reserve there's no jobs, and you're concerned that if you were to raise your kids in this dependency mode, will they also become dependent on someone else's for their own well-being and for their livelihood? And like any other reserve, I'm sure, rather than wait for somebody to give you a good, decent job, and in which they couldn't anyway, so one day I was coming home from up the road, and I seen this machine there with digging, and I seen these six Native guys watching the six non-Native guys working with pick and shovel. Man, I says, there's something wrong with this picture. If this was a task in which it could be considered or construed as very high tech, but I don't think pick and shovel, you don't need much technology or much education. All you need is a good elbow grease. So I came home and I told my wife, I said, I think, you know, I'm going to go into construction. She never said you never been even on a bulldozer before. She never said that. But it just so happened shortly after that, there was an auction where there was this one bulldozer being put on an auction. And I was fortunate enough to know somebody here that was familiar enough with this machinery. So I went and I asked him, I said, can you help me out? What? He says, I want to purchase this bulldozer, but I don't know what to look for, you know, so I can put a price on it that would be reasonable. So he told me all this, but he says, I'll tell you what, I'll go with you. So after going over that machine, he said, I wouldn't put any more than $6,500 on this machine. That was a long time ago. And then we got it. So I worked that for a while, and then worked at and got something else. So eventually, I kept those six guys that I saw watching those non-Native guys working with a pick and shovel. I didn't want to disappoint anyone. So Instead of names, I put numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. As I was progressing or growing, I threw these 6 numbers in the hat. And whatever is picked, there'll be a name on it. That's how I eventually ended up hiring those 6 guys. I didn't want to say, you know, you. No, I didn't want to make that. I didn't want to disappoint anyone. So I choose a number. So anyway, make a long story short, I eventually got enough gear, enough work to hire those 6 guys. Most of them are gone now, but most of them are still doing it today. So I guess the reason why I want to share that story is that we may sometimes believe and think we're so inadequate because we don't have this, we don't have that. But I believe if we can somehow look beyond us, beyond that, and allow the spirit of curiosity to kind of lead you on, because I believe with curiosity, if you allow it to go into overdrive, invoke something in your brain. You don't verbalize it, but you come to some kind of a realization that you can do it. You can do it, and if you do it, help will come along. And I think this is something that we've kind of... And this is not only me. I mean, I think this is something that was very much inherent, at least to my way of observing, people that have suffered tremendously from oppressions, from denials, and discrimination, that somehow they managed to extract that little extra energy from that's within us, so that we can become resilient. And once that energy kicks in, then I don't think anything is impossible. Because we have somehow, without even realizing and knowing, we have somehow managed to reawaken the spirit that's in all of us. And that spirit is there to give us not only the directions, but the energy for us to undertake anything that we put our mind to it. And that energy, I believe, will assist us.
So how old were you when you had hired the 6 guys?
Pardon?
How old were you when you hired the 6 guys and were running
well,
the construction?
Well, that would have been... See, I was born in 1938. And this would have been, I would say about 78, 79. And within a couple of years. So if I was 78, 38, 48, 58, 68, 78, 50 years old. I'm sure that looks old, but you know, you don't even think about those. You don't think about your age. You're overly concerned and anxious of being a good father, good provider, and a good mentor for your own kids. So you don't have the luxury of thinking about and saying, you know, I'm old, but you know. But anyway, that's the this is not an Albert Marshall story. This is to me is a Mi'kmaq story. Because I am sure as you go about the community, you will find many, many more people that have somehow managed to secure some kind of a stability in their lives through their efforts, whatever efforts they may have used. Because one of the greatest challenges you have here is that, you know, first of all, you have to realize that as a Native person, you cannot rely on the outside for employment. Whatever you want to accomplish, you have to somehow try to accomplish it from within. And the only way that you can actually do that is that you cannot rely on someone hiring you. So you can then now focus all your energy. Since nobody's going to hire me, well, I better figure out how I can hire myself by starting some kind of a business or something in which you will be able to sustain yourself, your family, and eventually others. So I believe this is something that I believe is still very much alive, even though we now have been under this, what I would call this dependency syndrome that has been imposed upon us by the government in so many ways by denying us get education so they can we become employable or we can become at least get an entrance in some technical institutions. But the problem there, though, you know, is that unless you have certain amount of an education background, you cannot access those technical trainings. So I believe I am very fortunate and very appreciative that there was enough people there, you know, supporting you whatever way they can, because it's something I believe that has not been able to be eradicated or suppressed, and that is the reason why I believe who we are as Mi'kmaq people held us together was through this, what I would like to refer to as this collective consciousness. And that collective consciousness can help and assist anyone that will embrace it. Because that collective consciousness was not only a place of refuge, just like any battlefield. These soldiers that are out in the front line, every once in a while they have to be relieved and put on this area somewhere in which for them to allow them to recover, not just from the battle fatigue, from fatigues from all areas. And I think this is something that, and I don't know where it is, how it is, but I know it's there. And it's ingrained into this concept of collective consciousness. That you know that you are among group of people, that there is nowhere in the world that you cannot succumb because you have these people around you. And no matter what happens on the outside, you know that you can always come to place like Eskisoni in which you would feel safe. And I believe the greatest felt sense of security was what I would like to call the spirit of collective consciousness, because you know people are there. You can talk to them, they can talk to you, and you can talk to whatever, and you're home.
How did you see, how long were you in construction? Did you shift to a different job afterwards, or?
Well, you see, when you go into a business, you're somewhat very naive. But as time goes on, you become aware that most businesses have to walk these very tight wire, in which either you become corrupt, or either you stick by your principles. As my construction company was growing, I was beginning now to be able to bid bigger projects, and I was somewhat successful in obtaining some of those contracts. But as you are acquiring more and more experience, and as you are acquiring more and more opportunities, also it's going to generate other things in which you got to make a conscious choice. So I'll give you an example. If you bid on a contract and you put out the best that you can, hopefully that you'll get it, and the politicians approach you. Let's say this one was a half a million dollar contract. Put the bid in for $600,000, and give us the $100,000. You got the contract, no questions asked. For me, that has somehow grew up with certain kinds of principles. As much as I want to retain and maintain this good life, but I had to make a choice. Do I keep it and compromise my convictions and of course the answer was obvious. Your principles are your overarching objective, so you refuse, and you know what's going to happen, and it did happen. If you don't play the ball, you're not going to be on the team. But I didn't really realize that not only how people can adjust and adapt, or how can they be resilient if you allow yourself to go there. Now, from residential school, for me, I believe I led a very secure life. I've been in seclusion. Other than my family, I was not interested in socializing or anything. Therefore, I never really knew until 1980s. my wife decided she wants to go back to school. I said, sure. So she went to UNB, got her BED. And decided that she wants to further her education. And of course, you know, at that time, we were still under the control of Indian Affairs. So when Merdina went to apply for funding for her to go to university, the Indian agent sarcastically said, I suppose you want to go to Harvard. Merdina had no intentions of going to Harvard at that point. But just despite that guy, she came home, she said, I'm going to Harvard. Now, but we sort of missed out on that one because, you see, if we had been a American Indian, we are in fact American Indian because of the Jay Treaty. And Harvard University still has something in the books in which education would be free for the Aboriginal people. But for some reason, because I don't know what, but we never qualified. But Merdina went there anyway, and then we got, and you know, tuitions were quite high, $14,000 then, them days. And so that's how. And then after that, of course, she always wanted to be part of enhancing our culture, our languages, and our ways of being, our ways of knowledge. And since, I believe, at the time, she felt that there wasn't enough flexibility within the structure from K-1 to K-12, for example, because I'm just reiterating what she told me, that there were very, very, very few flexibilities within the system in which you could actually begin to integrate our ways of knowing into the system. But according to her observation, within the institutions, universities, there are these flexibilities. So she applied at the university and got hired, and eventually, as time went on, she applied for tenure and she was refused for the simple reason that the Board of Governors felt that she had not written enough material to substantiate the requirement. But again, even though this was something in which we totally believe and understand about knowledge, that knowledge is alive, physically and spiritually. And if knowledge is alive and it has its own spirit, how can I then claim it? Because again, through the culture or through the language, you are constantly reminded that knowledge will transform you. But you also have a responsibility of sharing that knowledge. So here you have a conflict between one set of standards and one set of principles from the Aboriginal perspective, in which even though she has written maybe more than anyone else, but everything that she has written, her name wouldn't be on it because of the fact it's not her knowledge. And she had a sense of responsibility of sharing it. So, but through the help and assistance of colleagues, she did manage to get her tenure once this became known. And eventually, she really blossomed very quickly. Because, you know, I knew, and everybody else, well, a lot of people know that she was raised by one of the greatest chiefs, Gabriel Silliboy, her grandfather, Grand Chief Gabriel Silliboy. So she was literally overflown with traditional knowledge and living it. So as this word kept spreading, within the Maritimes, she would prefer to drive. And most cases, you know, we got a kids, family, and everything else, and most times she will not get ready, she will not have the time to prepare for whatever lecture that she's going to do. So she, seasonal employment. I worked for the guys operating machinery. So most times, you know, I was free anyway. So she said, why don't you come with me and, you know, drive while I'm preparing for my thing. And then, of course, once we get to that place, you know, she said, you might as well come in. And I kept listening. And observing and what she was doing. And then that went on for a long period of time, and eventually when she was at the university, I believe she was doing tasks that normally maybe five or six people would be required to do it. Eventually, not only because she got burned out, but she got sick. But she still had all these commitments. Some places she was well enough for me to go with her. And whenever I can, I would pitch in to help her out. Other times, instead of her sending her regrets or canceling it, she said, why don't you go? What then am I going to say? Well, it's not hard, she says. You got to put this in your head, that if you're going to talk about who you are as a Mi'kmaq person, you have to bypass that head of yours and speak from the heart. You cannot go wrong. And you know what? Pretty hard for me to believe it at the time, but when I reflect back on it now, after what, 25, 30 years or more, I think that's something that is so profound that people want to hear something like that. When people are speaking from their heart, and especially for me, because it was very evident that I was speaking from my heart, because with my grade 6 education, mainstream education system, I did not have the ability to go there with a long written speech, so I had to rely on my heart. And you know what? my heart has not failed me yet. So, I believe we are now at a crossroads, I believe. We have spent enough time hearing as many as we can of who we are as Mi'kmaq people. And now, the crossroads I'm referring to, I believe we have spent enough time informing people of who we are. Now, I believe we now have to create just as much of an energy as how do we put this into action now, in which most institutions, especially the institutions, would feel somewhat not compelled but comfortable for them to be able to seek out and ask, how can we begin this co-learning journey together? Because obviously this traditional knowledge, as we refer to it, there seems to be a lot of appetite for it. And I guess as more and more people got an opportunity to listen and to reflect, the demands will get big, more and more, and get bigger and bigger. But just like I showed you at the beginning here, that paper that we produced in 1995, and I'm going to represent that again in Fredericton next week, not much has changed within the institutions. But I believe, but what we have now, which we didn't have at that time, was that we were so busy, we were so conscientious about it, of spending as much time sharing our stories of who we are. But now I believe we have reached a crossroad in which we have spent enough time sharing our stories, and a time has come now in which we should be at least in a place with the institutions for us to begin this dialogue. How do we move forward together? You, as an Aboriginal person, bringing forth our Mi'kmaq ways of knowing, and how those our Mi'kmaq ways, how can they be integrated into the Eurocentric system, in which I believe will not only benefit our own students, but I believe it will benefit everyone by and large, because I believe we not only have, it's not only something that is inherent in us of looking at everything from another perspective, not necessarily to pick out the negatives, but rather how do we train ourselves to constantly take this information, fine-tune it, so whatever the outcome might be, or whatever the outcome that could be expected, if I take that knowledge and fine-tune it over and over again, I can then transform it so that if there's an action needed to happen, I can be just as much part and parcel of that force, because now my spirit is in that, whereas before it wasn't. Anyway.
Can you tell us a bit about, if you're comfortable sharing, about the stuff that happened with your son and the kind of... You were involved in a court case against...
Pardon?
You were involved in a court case afterwards with...
Oh, yes.
With the land and stuff here?
You see, as I said, when our kids came home from Boston, they could not get enough about the outdoors. So, one of my sons, Tommy, we were in a place in which this, there was a plane going back and one going flying over. Looks like a crop duster up west, spraying something. We didn't know what it was. And this was in September, and shortly after, he started getting sick. Eventually, ended up at the IWK in Halifax. And eventually was diagnosed with, I don't know, at that point, at that time, they were calling it a plastic anemia. I don't know what that means. But I do know, I believe, the symptoms in which instead of white cells overproducing, these red cells were dying. So, the doctors were very curious of testing all the chemicals that normally would be used in a household, Javex or whatever. And we never got the results of any of them. Eventually, that's in 1987. He was sick all that fall. That picture over there, that family picture, that's the Christmas Eve of 1987. 77, I'm sorry. And that would have been the last picture that he would be on it. So he died January 12th in 78. That's how fast and that's when we realized, known that for this kind of an illness to be triggered, it has to be triggered by some very strong chemical. And even though it was never at least said to us in any certain terms that all the household chemicals that we normally are using, those were eliminated except Agent Orange. Then it dawns on me that...
Leo!
Buddy!
Hi, sorry, I'll edit this out of the video.
Well, sorry.
No, don't worry about it.
No, we're done anyway.
Yeah. I would even burp coming in.
Yeah.